to another episode of the William Branham Historical Research Podcast. I'm your host, John Collins, the author and founder of William Branham Historical Research at william-branham.org, and with me I have my co-host and friend, Steve Montgomery, author of The Converging Apostasy and A Quick Outline on Hands-on Eschatology, A Matter of Timing and Agency. And together, we're discussing the themes of apostasy that is in the New Apostolic Reformation, and today, also in Russian mysticism. There's so many wide varieties of topics that we cover, Steve, and the last one we did, Russian mysticism, it threw me a bit off kilter because it's something I've wanted to study and haven't really dive too deeply into it, but now you're diving even deeper and you're making my brain get some exercise, so I thank you for that. But I'm excited today to talk more about the Russian mysticism.
Yeah, good deal, John. And for you guys that don't know John's skill set, other than being a researcher, he's quite a computer fella. And so I was teasing him that before this one started, you know, I have certain messages on my computer says, click here, do this, do this. And I'm thinking, what? And John, I call him up. He says, yeah, do click there, don't do this, do this. And it's like a miracle. Everything's up and running. Yeah. So thanks to John for that.
To be fair, I use my deliverance ministry on it. I was praying that the demons would be cast out of your computer.
That is a wonderful introduction to what comes up next. So I was thinking of the circle of apostasy. There's actually probably more than one, and they converge with each other. But for this podcast, I have when Russian mysticism, Persian mysticism, and the Nar converge. And so Persian would be before the Muslim empire and Muhammad and so on. So it goes back to ancient times. So as an introduction, I have here that Russian mysticism was influenced by the angelology of Jacob Boehm, who we probably mentioned several times in relation to Jane Lead and other esotericists. Also influential was Persian Sufi mysticism, which I don't think you and I have talked about that. But Persian Sufi mysticism is another crossroads in what I would think of as apostasy. And then also the spiritualist Emanuel Swedenborg. So in Russian mysticism, icons are seen as a means of connecting with essentially guardian angels. And this connection between icons and angels is deeply rooted in Neoplatonism. Okay, and so we've talked about that and even how Platonism and Neoplatonism have contributed to Jane Lead. And you can actually hear some of the Lateran prophets under her influence who frankly sound as if they've just been studying Neoplatonism and injected it into their worldview and their presentation. Like Hindu mystics, Sufi mystics, and the Neoplatonists, Russian mystics seek essentially union with God. This became less important in the West from about the 12th century, but not so in Russian mysticism. This being able to have union with God was still a big thing and still is in certain sectors. So in the 20th century, there was also a return a Valentinian-based sophiology. So Valentinius would have been the second century Gnostic. Then you have current things today like the wisdom goddess movement, and it's just a modern version of what we're talking about here. And then what's interesting to me, and John, your ideas about weaponized religion. Some in the Russian Orthodox Church have used their version of eschatology to justify political and military action, such as with the war in Ukraine.
As I said before, this was a topic that fascinates me, and your discussion last time honestly sent me down a path of self-examination, because you started talking about the angels and the guardian angels, etc. You kind of hinted that we were getting into it more today. And I got to thinking about the way that we believed in Branhamism, and now comparing that to the way that we believe in the mainstream Christian churches that I've attended. It gets a little bit odd, because as we've talked about it before, but William Branham's mentor, Roy Davis, who was the Klan leader, came and posed as a converted spiritualist. And there's evidence that William Branham attended the spiritualist camp in Indiana. And the early versions of his ministry has a high element of spiritualism. He talks about how he, through the power of his mind, can move bracelets, and how he can take the head of a child with crossed eyes and look at it and make it come straight without even praying for it. He's talking about very, very odd things, not what you would hear from a Christian minister. But take it to the other end of the spectrum. Whenever somebody dies in these movements, and some extent you hear this in mainstream Christianity, but for instance, you might have a funeral and the minister might speak and say, and her spirit is here now watching us. Well, how far do you go with that? In some cases, in Branhamism, the spirit who's watching you, the spirit of the dead, can become a guardian angel of sorts, somebody who's actually watching out for you. And I got to thinking about it, that's not really scriptural, but it does match a lot of the pagan religions. And so then I started re-examining what I believed on people who die, how you interact with them, can you interact with them? And it all goes back to the passages in the Old Testament where that interaction with the dead spirits is actually pretty evil.
Yeah, I think that's a big line to draw, which I think I did last time we talked about this, between Trisha Yearwood recently and Amy Grant in the 80s. Amy Grant is saying that there are angels looking out for us. Okay, well, that's not seeking them out, attempting to evoke them or draw them down from heaven. And the more Neoplatonist view pretty much fits with what Trisha Yearwood was singing about, that she's calling down the angels. And of course, you can hear that all over the place in Anar and in their predecessors, say like Latter-day Folk. So one of the big figures in all of this stuff is Vladimir Solovyev. And he's considered like an ecumenical giant of Christian unity, apart from, in my view, doctrinal purity. So similar to the 17th century mystic Jan Leek, Solovyev, who lived from 1853 to 1900, said that Sophia, and he wasn't talking about wisdom, he's talking about a literal being. He said that Sophia appeared to him in mystical visions. Well, this sort of makes sense because Solovyev studied Valentinus, Kabbalah, Paracelsus, and other Jacob Born. He studied a lot of these fellows, and they're constantly talking about a figure named Sophia and her ability to interact with you, which doesn't fit with what you're talking about, John. It goes across that line. And so he also drew on esoteric sources, like I said, such as Gnosticism. Also, something very interesting, the Spiritist John Portage. Now, why I say interesting is because Portage was pretty much the mentor of Jane Lead. And what you're getting is kind of a pipeline from Jacob Born to Jane Lead and her mentor. If you go back before them, then you have this wide river of essentially what I would say false doctrine, esoteric content is coming from Valentinus all the way down through to Jane Lead. And then the fork kind of splits, and that influence goes on to more like, you'd say, cultic people, and there'll be Blavatsky and Bailey and even Aleister Crowley would show this kind of influence. So, you know, it's not a great swimming pool to dip your foot into. Now, but listen to what Solovyov has to say. He said that it's, quote, Russia's mission to unite Orthodox, Catholic, and Protestant Christians. That's interesting. You know, a lot of people wouldn't say that. They want to be exclusive, like we're the ones that have it, and follow no one else. But it kind of struck me as I was thinking, we ever heard that before? And they go, if you listen to the NAR prophet, Cindy Jacobs, she says that church growth calls for the complete unity of evangelicals, charismatics, and Pentecostals. She happens to have left out Catholics, but that same idea of joining together forces that may have previously not been so interested in working together. Set aside your petty differences. We hear that cliche all the time. Oddly enough, but not to me, or maybe not to you, John, this version of ecumenicalism is also reflected in the new, and the esoteric world through the New Age writings of Alice Bailey.
It's funny to me because there are so many examples of how a cult starts, where everybody's welcome. Come join me. Come out of your system and join my system. And they all start exactly like this. In Latter Rain, William Branham was the same. Catholics are welcome. Baptists are welcome. We're all one. Join us. But there's a fundamental problem with this. Each one of these groups that has a different ideology can never get along because those ideologies are so vastly different. You bring them all together, right, and what you have is a mess, right? And you find that the NAR, you mentioned Cindy Jacobs, I know there are others. They're trying to unite people with different ideologies under the same umbrella so that they can bring in essentially their money. If you look at it at its core, that's probably what's going on here. But nobody's really thinking from the other side how all of this plays out. Once they're joined in, well, who makes the rules? Who decides on doctrine? Who decides whenever something is anti-biblical or extra-biblical? Or in the case of the NAR or Latter Rain or Charismania, when is the extra-biblical to be considered spoken word biblical or rhema biblical? You know, they take each one of these things and their core belief system is so vastly different. But as a cult is growing, everybody's welcome, every ideology's welcome in our ideology, and we're just going to let this elephant in the room sit until somebody else can deal with all of the chaos.
Yeah, or you can get the elephant to do tricks for you at the circus.
Exactly.
And, it's interesting you bring that up, John, about the draw everybody in, the big tent, the circus, and then there starts to be squabbles and so on. Well, I've been working on this book, which I don't know if you've read it, John. Let me see if I can. It's called Black Sun, Aryan Cults, Esoteric Nazism, and the Politics of Identity. Well, it sounds like it's probably sensationalist sort of nonsense. It isn't. It's by a renowned scholar named Nicholas Goodrich-Clark. And one of the things I was recently reading there was actually about just what you said. You had people that were trying to revive the Nazi Party, skinheads, et cetera, and the worshippers of Odin, you know, trying to revive German pagan beliefs. And the story that you read, the discourse that you have in that book goes from so-and-so started this, and he was with the Nazi Party in America. But then he joined with so-and-so, and they had a splitting of the ways, and they're just like reforming and reforming. Sounds like they can't arrive anywhere. So, yeah, that's a good point, which also leads to the next little segment I have here is Alexander Dugin and the Politics of Russian Mysticism. So, Dugin had a big, you know, he's been called everything from this to that, but essentially, I think it's fair to call him a esoteric fascist, and he's pretty tight with Putin. He's kind of in the back seat nowadays, but his influence is still felt. So, similar to the Third Reich of Nazi Germany, Dugin said that Moscow would become the Third Rome. Dugin also identifies United States with the Antichrist. And Interestingly, he says, this is a direct quote, "I see no reason why Putin will hesitate to use nuclear weapons if Russia starts to fail." Now, he's not talking about fail in general. I think he's talking about fail in Ukraine. But this is pretty much Dugin's basis for what is essentially homicidal fantasies in which the whole world goes down in a blaze of glory.
It brings back weird memories hearing you talk about this. I love World War II history and studying it. I would often study the Third Reich and everything that that entailed. And then in Branhamism, you had the third pool. In Nazism, you had the third wave. And interestingly, in Pentecostalism, it also now has a third wave. You have these waves of three, and you wonder, what is this weird thing? But you mentioned something here that's really of interest, that Dugin believed that the United States was the Antichrist. In Branhamism, mm-hmm. and also what I would say that there are certain pillars of the NAR that believe this as well. They believe that the Antichrist will come out of the United States because that was one of Branham's twisted predictions. It was actually a political prediction that he invented much later in his ministry, but in the later years, he claimed that way back in 1933, he had this alleged prophecy that the Pope would come out of the United States. What's interesting is, now that we do have a Pope that is out of the United States, the message community is going berserk because they think, well, this is it. This is the Antichrist. This is the end of days. Mm-hmm. So in a weird way, they tied together. But where it gets problematic when you're thinking converging apostasy, as all of these ebbs and flows of the apostasy seem to creep into other movements, you have the NAR with those branches that do believe William Branham to be a prophet. And they're seeing this weird prophecy. The moment that they come in contact with that Russian mysticism theme, they're going to believe that elements of that are actually somewhat divine. And so they give more credence to whoever's speaking than had they never heard this before. So as this all is weaving together, it weaves into this weird mess that's really difficult to even untangle.
Yeah, the part about that weaving together is, you know, people like Richard Spencer, just basically white supremacists have in the last 10, 15 years had this this connection that Russia is no longer the evil empire over there that we're opposed to, the communists, but actually it's a bastion of white power and we will somehow work together with them. And, you know, that kind of ebbs and flows depending on what's happening in American and Russian politics. But basically, there is an undercurrent of what you're talking about is what I've seen also. So another thing that I came up with was I ran across this name, Nikolai Berdyaev, in Russian mysticism. Okay. Berdyaev happens to be another person who Putin really favors. He thinks he's great. So to me, this becomes another fork in the road of apostasy. So Berdyaev lived from 1874 to 1948. So what did he believe? We see a little bit about this, a condensed version in his so-called The Truth of Orthodoxy. And he's kind of meaning Russian mysticism out of one side of his mouth and Russian Orthodoxy on the other side. So in this, Berdyaev essentially shows his version of what I always call hands-on eschatology, meaning God should be in control of the end of times. However, a lot of folks that we're keeping track of disagree. They think that they're going to be ones to turn the tide. So sounding like the NAR, Berdyaev said, quote, "Unlike Catholicism and Protestantism, Russian Orthodoxy's eschatological anticipation of an outpouring of the Holy Spirit will result in the transfiguration of the world." So that the eschatology is not exactly what a lot of other folks would say, you know, like what he says, Protestants and Catholics would normally not agree. However, the NAR would in a lot of ways. So in agreement with this other fellow, Soloviev, Berdyaev said, quote, Russian Orthodoxy's more pure form of Christianity is a good basis for unity. Yeah, let's have unity, but let's do it my way. And so, yeah, that's pretty hypocritical. And I think of that as like the avaricious Narbim, which seeks to pull in all Christians under its elite rulership. And according to Berdyaev, Russian Orthodoxy promotes universal salvation and the deification of both man and the cosmos. Well, now you're getting into some esoteric territory, and you're getting into some areas, maybe like Origen and other theologians that were very, very controversial in these sorts of matters. Also, like Jane Lee, Berdyaev believed in the possibility of salvation for those who have died in a state of sin.
So here's where it gets really scary for me. And the irony is that today, while we're recording this, even though it will come out much later, President Trump is meeting with President Putin, and the whole world is watching this thing. Most people who are Americans are watching this in terror, those who are not in the MAGA crowd, because they're seeing President Putin, who has just been bombarding Ukraine for no apparent reason other than what appears to be a land grab, and the fact that President Trump is entertaining it. A lot of people are really skeptical of this meeting, and why was not, you know, the leader of Ukraine, the one who's being attacked, why is he not into this forum? So while the world is thinking that, now you have this weird foundation where the people who are influenced by Branhamism and apparently these streams that you're mentioning, it's not so bad that you do this. If it's for the end, the ends justifies the means, basically. If I can conquer the world, repurpose the world to my own utopia, then it's a good thing. There will be some growing pains when we get there. Many, many people will die while we get there. But the end result is we will end in utopia. And if you really look at its core, I know that Branham did not teach that we should invade countries and this sort of thing. But what he did teach laid the foundation for what we see in this, in that the path to its logical conclusion, as people in the NAR are starting to make, if the Antichrist is coming out of Russia and this whole world is going to be repurposed for our domain, for our dominion, somehow we have to achieve that dominion, and there will be a time where there's a battle and many people will die, and this is a good thing. It is a good thing that people will die. That's where it gets really scary, because in a normal church that's not part of this movement, not part of this cult, you would never think this way. This is horrific that you think this way. And you look back into the 60s, you look at the white supremacists, the things that they were teaching in Christian identity, and you can expect somebody who's domestic terrorist or even actual terrorist, global terrorist, to think this way. But now we're talking about Christianity thinking like terrorists. And it's horrifying when you think about it.
Yeah, that reminds me of the time that I talked to Bill Britton's daughter, Becky, and she was telling me that she felt like, oh no, my dad never taught anything about what I call the sacred purge or taking dominion. She says he was just trying to preach the higher spiritual life of sonship. And so I made a few quotes from his books and told her that I had interviewed a couple of associate pastors at Bill Britton's House of Prayer Church. And she was really taken aback. And she said, well, the only people that could think like that would be dictators. And I said, yeah, you know, it's pretty spooky stuff. And dictators talk that way. So I actually ran into a new name for me in this search. As his name is Henry Corbin, and he was French, so I think it's Henri, forget it, I don't know what to say about his last name, and his connection with Russian mysticism. So Corbin was a true scholar. I forgot how many languages he could speak and write in. He was very, very well read, but he kind of got the mystic bug. And where did he get that? Well, he got it from this fellow, Nikolai Berdyaev, the Russian mystic. Corbin lived from 1903 to 1978. So the Russian mystic Sergius Bulgakov which was 1871 to 1944, also influenced Corbin. From this influence and his studies of Persian mysticism, Corbin developed what he called Shiite sociology. Now, sociology has mostly been seen as a Russian movement in the late 1800s, early 1900s. So this connection where he it's already a conversion, so he's taking Shiite concepts from Persia, and that goes into Sufism, which is their form of mystic practices, and connecting it to what's more essentially a Russian phenomenon. So I kind of wrapped it up like this with him. I said Corbin in a nutshell, and this is if I could highlight this and put it in bold red ink, I think you would hear where this connects with an awful lot of previously discussed forms of mysticism and even downright occultism. So Corbin said, quote, "The celestial hierarchies of the great Neoplatonist Proclus, as well as those of Valentinian Gnosis and Islamic Gnosis, lead to angelomorphosis, aka union with one's angelic heavenly counterpart." That's what he said. So there again, yeah, that does go into the thing that you were thinking that we might get into. And so I would love to avoid this topic, but it shows up again and again and again. Anytime there's some kind of idea about becoming perfected, set apart, the elite, or even for some folks, immortal and divine, the angels quite often get shuffled into that conversation. So Corbin was introduced to another core belief for many Persian Shia, and it's similar to what the New Age writer Alice Bailey's idea said about the reappearance of the Christ. And what he learned about is called the reappearance of the hidden imam. The hidden imam is essentially a messianic figure in eschatology, pretty much Persian eschatology, who is to eventually return as a savior called the Mahdi. So this makes the goal of Shia theosophy to be the divinization of the believer and preparations for the advent of the savior Mahdi. Oddly enough, when I was reading that, I said, I know you like science fiction, John. I remember it, I think in junior high, I read Frank Herbert's The Dune trilogy. Okay, so, and now we have the movies, part one and part two, and then it's projected part three will come out sometime in 2026. But the interesting part of this is the central character of Dune is Paul Atreides. And he becomes the Mahdi to the desert-dwelling Fremen.
It's just like the Matrix. Many good stories are built on the same exact themes that we're talking about, the cults and the world of cults. I think I told you this. I was working with Dr. Stephen Hassan, and he told me that he was taking part in developing the concept for the Star Trek Borg. Because the Borg, that you think of the Hive Queen, it's very much like the cult leader, the central figure. Each of the people who are in the Borg network, as soon as they get disconnected from that network, they keep trying to plug back in, and they're just totally disoriented when they are unplugged. It's so many themes are based off of the cult aspects, and I sometimes wonder if not all of the great science fiction authors that I've read had some sort of experience with bad experience with religion, because their themes usually are the religious good guys versus the religious bad guys or the cult leaders. And Dune is one of those. It is one of my favorite movies. But back to what we're talking about here, it's a little, again, it's really scary because if you think in terms of the worst that the sci-fi authors can create, and then compare that to what we have today, it's as though what is being written as science fiction is playing out in our world, and it's all because of this converging apostasy. Have you ever wondered how the Pentecostal movement started, or how the progression of modern Pentecostalism transitioned through the Latter Rain, Charismatic, and other fringe movements into the New Apostolic Reformation? You can learn this and more on William Branham Historical Research's website, william-branham.org. On the books page of the website, you can find the compiled research of John Collins, Charles Paisley, Stephen Montgomery, John McKinnon, and others, with links to the paper, audio, and digital versions of each book. You can also find resources and documentation on various people and topics related to those movements. If you want to contribute to the cause, you can support the podcast by clicking the Contribute button at the top. And as always, be sure to like and subscribe to the audio or video version that you're listening to or watching. On behalf of William Branham Historical Research, we want to thank you for your support.
There's a fellow who wrote the book on, what did he call it, the Adjustment Bureau, something like that. And it's purely based on the influence of Theosophical Society and the notion that there are ascended masters, you know, kind of leading us and guiding us and revealing revelations to prepare for our encounter with the Christ. So, yeah, and then another guy came up who I'd never heard of, and that's Shihab Suhrawardi and Jacob Boehm, who I've heard of quite a bit. And these both became backdrops for Corbin's thought. So here's where it comes down to convergence. Corbin wanted to unite Russian Orthodoxy and mysticism with Islamic mysticism. That's kind of a tall order, but in 1939, he moved to Istanbul and studied the works of the Iranian mystic Suhrawardi. Now, that goes back a long way because he lived in 1155 to 1191. And Suhrawardi was the founder of a sect or a philosophy called Illuminism, which was based almost entirely on Neoplatonic theurgy. And of course, theurgy is the drawing down of spirits, and you can command them, they can give you insights and whatever you want to do with them, I suppose. He said that those illuminated by these lights of light are to become the rulers of the universe, and whatever these elite command will be obeyed. Well, we're talking about stuff, you know, back in the 1100s, and yet that kind of blows off the tongue, like what I hear NAR prophets talk about, you know, commanding angels to do this and that and so on. Both Suhrawardi and Boehm blended spiritual traditions. In Suhrawardi's case, that was the mixing of Platonism and Iranian Sufi mysticism of the 10th century. In Boehm's case, he drew upon alchemy, Kabbalah, and the writings of Paracelsus. Both of their syncretic mythologies highly influenced Corbin. So here's a way that this kind of panned out. Corbin said that if the spiritual seeker is having trouble uniting with their so-called celestial partner, then Al-Kirdi, a.k.a. the Green Angel, yes, that's what he called it, would act as a spirit guide to assist them. With his help, you could become connected to the godlike characters, and you already mentioned it, John, of Corbin's multiverse. Okay, who are those characters? Well, one of them that can guide you into all truth is Hermes Trismegistus, who supposedly coined the very famous occultic phrase, as above, so also below. Samael, the demonic seducer, who in the occult world is favorably associated with Lucifer, and also in the occult world, esoteric Christianity, you get the Lucifer-like Sophia of Valentinian Gnosticism.
I tell you, this episode has got my head going all kinds of different directions. You're talking about Dune and hijacked my thoughts. I was thinking about Dune while you were talking and totally missed. And then you said lights of light or something like this. There's a cartoon from the, I think it's the 80s, where this guy wielding a sword says, "Lords of Light," and starts fighting the bad guys. Well, what's funny is as my mind was hijacked there, then you pulled it back by talking about the color, the green angel, and that green spirit, because this is something that I never understood when I was in Branhamism. Then after I left, it makes even less sense, and I don't know what really to make of it other than maybe it is coming from this flow of this converging apostasy. But William Branham, when he would talk about the spirit that came near to him when he was doing his alleged healing, and as you know, he claimed this to be the presence of an angel. And we also know that in IHOP KC, Bob Jones, Todd Bentley, many of these other guys, they claim that they have Branham's angel. Well, Branham claimed that his angel was a greenish color. There's this greenish glow that would come when the presence comes near.
Interesting.
But what's odd about it is he would always say, and then that amber light comes through, that yellow greenish light comes through. When I was in the cult, I was like, well, don't you know amber is not a greenish color? It's more of a reddish orangish color. But he would always say that, and you can look it up. For whatever reason, he's saying this, but he, regardless of the color he incorrectly names it, he always describes it as this greenish glow that was in his presence. I don't know of a single person who ever witnessed the greenish glow. I do know people that claim that they saw a light or some strange thing. And oddly, the light that they describe was more the amber-colored light, so you can tell it's kind of subliminally in their head. But the greenish, the green one, I've never met anybody who yet has been this presence. So we have listeners who believe that William Branham was truly tapping into demonology to do what he did. I believe he was a con artist and he was just playing with their minds. If you lean towards the he's working with a demon, well, now you've got this weird greenish color demon that's on the platform with him.
Yeah, and as you're saying that, myself being a musician, I'm thinking, well, what about Purple Haze? You know, it's like Jimi Hendrix would have. And I'm not promoting his lifestyle or his music per se, but Purple Rain from Prince.
Yeah.
I began to see something and I thought, well, apostasy converges, but it also metastasizes. Okay, so yeah, the idea of like a cancer. So like Nikolai Fedorov, the founder of Russian Cosmism, that was in 1827 through 1903, Corbin also called for a utopian collective action. So he's not leaving that in the hands of God or some spiritual forces. He's saying, let's get this done. And why did he want to do this? Because he wanted to, quote, resurrect the dead and then be able to achieve self-deification. That theme actually has come through Alexander Dugin. He also talks about bringing back it's like the ancestor worship almost. It's like a pagan ancestor worship. And they will be the ones that are the spearhead of carrying out the judgment day. So like Thanar and Sergius Bulgakov, Fedorov emphasized bypassing all dogmatic divisions through a shared eschatology. So there's where, if there's any hope, or it's not a good hope, but if there's any hope these guys can count on of working together, it's okay, you guys believe that, that's not that important, but yeah, we're going to take over and we're going to get rid of all these liberals and others that are, and the Jews and so on. So another person who influenced Corbin was Joachim of Fiore. He lived from 1135 to 1202. There could be a long discussion about him, but I mentioned him one or two times before. But he influenced Corbin by promoting a new era of the Holy Spirit, aka Christianity of the Third Testament. He said the first one was the Father, the second one was the Son, the third era, the Christian church will be the Holy Spirit, and it will do everything that the manifest sons of God later were to say. So oddly enough, he also influenced in some interesting ways Christopher Columbus, and he influenced most definitely the ideas of the Third Reich, you know, being that Third Testament, although he wasn't, as far as I know, a racist and didn't hate Jews. Like Jane Lead, this is one I would maybe present this to you later to maybe do some co-research on this fellow. Alexander Tuberosky said that all sinners and non-Christians will be made spiritual, incorruptible, and therefore glorious. Like Jane Lead and those she influenced in the latter rain, Tuberosky also said that the church on earth, the militant church, will merge with the heavenly church. That is almost, well, it's not a direct quotation, but it is stated in such a familiar way that you hear from Bill Britton, Roy Cronquist in the latter end, and also from Jane Lead. She specifically says things like this. And you hear things pretty close to that in the North. So similar to Alexander Dugin, Tuberosky also compared Russia's great patriotic war in Ukraine to the Passion of Christ. I would say one of those two elements is being insulted and blasphemed.
And that further proves the idea that I'm having forming in my mind as I began to research all of this. Many of the ideas that we had in Christian identity that were developed into the Latter Rain movement, specifically what William Branham was introducing into the Latter Rain movement. And then you see some of the leaders of Latter Rain taking on the very militant, some of them outright race war themes, some of them the militant church and combining with their celestial bodies, marrying with their heavenly bodies, all this weird stuff. It did not originate with Christian identity. And Christian identity obviously borrowed largely from British Israelism, but woven through this were all of these external, I don't even know what you call it other than heresy, all of these different ideas that really came from pagan roots. And those pagan roots influenced people who were respected in their, whatever was their area at the time. And other people built doctrines upon those as though they were true and sound and biblical and called it Christianity. So you had all of these different varying disparate groups of pseudo-Christianity beliefs, pseudo-Christian beliefs, that started to merge and form into the foundations for what we see developing in today's world. And that's why some of the aspects seem very primitive when you look at it. You think Christian identity, for example, talking about the mud people, that sounds like something that you would see as a child in a cartoon, not something that an adult would say behind the pulpit in a church. But yet there were people saying this kind of thing. It's because it came from very primitive pagan roots, and it starts flowing into the church world today. Sadly, those foundations were laid, and it's layers upon layers upon layers of foundations. So many of the ideas today come from the same roots.
Yeah, and the kind of roots that we hear in Scripture will be chopped out because they're not doing as they ought to. Well, finally, I'd like to give a shout out to Laura at Magical Mystery Church. She's been taking segments of my my Converging Apostasy and some of the things that I've written about, and she's reading through them and giving explanation. I think she does a good job, and she has a interesting way of presenting things, John. She's got a sense of humor. So this next segment, I call it, and now for something completely expected. So that, you know, it sounds almost like what you'd hear from Monty Python, but reversed. So I found this document and I said, oh yeah, now we're getting somewhere. This is an article. I couldn't find the date of it because it was translated from Russian and they didn't decide to put that in there. But in English, the title is The New Apostolic Reformation, NAR, and Russian Orthodoxy, in quotations, as a political weapon, colon, how the new U.S. government aligned with Russia on the basis of religious fundamentalism. This is by Mariana Bezula. And I think if you did a search on that one, it comes up, and her ex, or used to be TikTok, or I forgot. I never use all that stuff. But you'll find it. And she says some obvious stuff, but it's good that she's noticing. She says there are ideological parallels between the NAR and so-called Putin's orthodoxy. In the NAR, she says Trump is God's chosen one fighting against satanic globalists. In Russia, Putin is the so-called anointed one of God, battling, quote, decadent Western liberalism. Now that's where you're getting right up the alley of Alexander Dugin. Then she says, both the NAR and Putin's orthodoxy use religion as a tool for political mobilization and aim at replacing democracy with theocracy. John, I think you're going, yeah, heard that one before. In the US, they have apostles and prophets. And she says that in Russia, they have a so-called Tsar Putin. But the goal of both is the same. It is to create a world where power is concentrated in the hands of righteous religious leaders. She states that dominionism in the NAR is building God's kingdom by taking control of the seven mountains. In Russia, dominionism is manifested in the concept of, quote, Holy Rus. Okay, so I had to look that one up, but that was easy enough. The idea of Holy Rus appeared in the 9th century. It basically said in those days, and presently too, that Russia has been chosen by God and enlightened by Eastern Orthodox Christianity. The Holy Rus makes Russia the spiritual center of the world. So the question this leads to me, I mean, several questions, but does any of this sound similar to the NAR's ideas of America as the, quote, New Jerusalem, with USA in caps?
And that's a very interesting topic that's probably worth an entire podcast. Because as you know, John Alexander Dowie, he created Zion City, and he was trying to claim that this was going to be the New Jerusalem. And there's numerous New Jerusalem cults that exist today. So where did they get this idea? It seems to be a very commonplace idea. I don't think in Branhamism that was the case. Before Branham was able to develop what the charismatic movement developed as far as kingdom theology and eventually the dominion theology, Branham died. So he didn't ride that wave. Otherwise, he would have copied and plagiarized those guys as he did in the, in the earlier years. But yes, the New Jerusalem theme seems to be something that is very prevalent.
Yeah, I can tell you that I can't give you a direct quote, but just having read quite a bit of Jane Leed's writings, she did talk about the New Jerusalem descending from heaven. And you can look at the Bible and you say, yeah, okay, well, it says essentially that. But she had this idea that it was going to descend from heaven, and Christ would be present in and through his elite prior to the return of his personal advent. So yeah, this idea that there's going to be this empowerment, and the fellow I mentioned earlier, Joachim de Fiore, he talked about this too. And so there's this Shekinah glory, as some would call it, the parousia, as the Bible would use that Greek word. There's the idea that there's a second coming with a first installment where the world is taken dominion of, and there's a transfer of wealth to the true believers, and the judgment day occurs. And all of that occurs prior to the return of the literal Jesus Christ.
What's fascinating research, and like I said earlier, last time you got me to thinking in ways that I haven't exercised my brain in a very long time. So I think this time may be worse. And I've got more to look up and more to study and more personal experiences to re-examine. Was that thing that I
Well,
believe scriptural or was it not?
yeah, and remember last time, what really got you was input about the elite eating pastries after spinning around and falling down.
Yeah, last time you got me incredibly hungry, and that's it's almost lunchtime here for me, so I think now you've done it again just by simply mentioning pastries.
Okay. Well, John, if I can give a plug for the next time, I don't know when we're going to do it. I think I know, but I found some very interesting documents about the latter rain, their influence in Ghana, and how there's a melding, which a lot of people might think is would happen. It did, a melding between latter rain ideas and practices and those of essentially a pagan society called the Akan, which is A-K-A-N. So I'm looking forward to throwing that your way and seeing what your comments are.
Awesome. Well, I look forward to it. If you've enjoyed our show and you want more information, you can check us out on the web. You can find us at william-branham.org. For more about the dark side of the New Apostolic Reformation, you can read Weaponized Religion, From Christian Identity to the NAR. And for more about the Converging Apostasy, you can read the book, The Converging Apostasy. And also, you can read A Quick Outline of Hands-on Eschatology, A Matter of Timing and Agency.